Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day. Hello and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano, and with me this week, as usual, Michael Hughes. How's it going, Michael?
Hey, Toby.
Pretty good. It's sad to be on the episode after last week, given how awesome that episode was. I wanted to let you know I really enjoyed it, and I wanted to tell listeners, if you're listening to this episode and you haven't listened to that one yet, you're making a mistake. You should go back and listen to that one.
Not because you need to understand what's in the last episode to understand this one, but just because it was really good, because Susie was great.
Exactly. All right,
so that's a great start. I mean, you always start out by telling the audience they're making a mistake by listening to the episode. That's always good. Now, it's funny because I was actually considering actually kind of adding to the opening the thing that everyone who has any show ever always adds, which is, we got a great show for you today, regardless of whether it's actually good or not, and you totally undercut my attempts to generate enthusiasm for this episode.
That's generally what I'm here for, to undercut your enthusiasm. I just don't like lying.
undercut general enthusiasm, not just me.
That's true.
I'm honestly not that enthusiastic, so it's...
That's actually why we can be friends.
We almost call this the Wet Blanket Podcast.
That's right.
Anyways, we got a great show for you today. What are we talking about today?
Today we're going to talk about Richard Wolff's Democracy at Work, Cure for Capitalism. It's a book that he's written on basically an extension of stuff that we've talked about previously in terms of anarcho-syndicalism. Right. So we talked about this in an earlier episode.
Entitled, What is Capitalism? It's a good episode. Check that out too. You're making a
but
mistake
you don't have,
if you don't listen to it.
You don't have to listen to that one before this one. If anything, they're going to be about the same quality. But yeah, so the basic idea of the book is that our workplaces are generally undemocratic. Most of us are wage laborers in some way, and we don't really get to make decisions about our workplace, except for where we will work. And the book is an extended argument for why that is responsible for many of the common problems that arise in modern capitalist economic systems.
Right, right. So part of it is identifying or presenting a particular critique of capitalism, of some of the major problems of capitalism that we see and that people on the left have been criticizing, identifying the cause of that, which is this, he takes to be this lack of democracy in the workplace, and then sort of offering this as a potential transformative solution to some of these problems of capitalism. And so what's interesting about this is that, and we kind of touched on this when we talked about capitalism in the previous episode, this is a dimension of economic systems that is often overlooked. Right. Often, you know, the distinction is between markets versus state planning and things like that. And we'll get into this in more detail. I don't want to get into it now. So this issue of workplace democracy or workplace monarchy or whatever is a dimension that's often overlooked. And so Wolff thinks this is a key to understanding the problems of capitalism and key to offering a novel alternative to it as well, which isn't, you know, the choices aren't between capitalism as we know it and communism as it's commonly understood. And that's an important discussion to have.
Yeah, this episode, I think this topic is germane to a lot of contemporary discussions that are going on right now. So Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez recently made a remark about automation sort of in itself not being the problem, right? And she said, I mean, the way it's, she's of course being demonized by the right where they're taking her words out of context, but she basically said, look, automation by itself is neither good nor bad. It depends on what we end up doing with the extra productivity that we get from it. If we use it to lay off people and, you know, enrich just a handful of the people who own the automation, then it's not going to be a net gain for society as a whole. But it doesn't have to be that way. And Wolff's work is very relevant to that, in part because he's observing that what we do with things like automation, our environment, very much depend on who gets to make choices, right? And the fact that there aren't democracies in the workplace have a profound impact on the kinds of decisions that people make. And so that's going to be the topic of the episode. And it seems to me highly relevant to what's going on today in contemporary politics.
Okay, so as we said, you know, the name of the book is Democracy at Work, A Cure for Capitalism. Okay, so what's wrong with capitalism? It sounds like capitalism there is a disease. Actually, I would recommend capitalitis, the inflammation of capital, potentially as a useful medical term. No, I'm
actually
kidding.
The inflammation of capital.
I know, right? It
also
works. It just sounds bad, right? Capitalitis.
Yeah.
It doesn't sound great. Anyways, if anyone has a better term, at the Badlands Pod on Twitter, let us know. But okay, I mean, so what is it about capitalism that makes it a disease, and what are its symptoms, right? What are the problems here that we're focusing on?
So the symptoms that Wolf identifies are the familiar symptoms that most people coming from the sort of progressive socialist Marxist traditions identify as problems of capitalism, right? So you have the perpetuation of growing inequality as a central part of capitalist systems, the exploitative nature of the capitalist arrangement, where some people are enriched while others are left impoverished. These seem to be features that are common to capitalist societies. The disregard for the environmental impact of our economic choices and the devastation of our environment over time, because we don't count those in our economic calculus. Then there's partially coming from those and partially just in virtue of the nature of the system. We also have sort of the instability of political systems, in particular democratic institutions that are embedded within a capitalist economic society.
And that's something that we've obviously focused on and something that contemporary progressives are very much sensitive to, which is that the idea that you can separate out the economic from the political, economic influence from political influence, is misguided. And, you know, in the first couple of episodes, we detailed some of the ways in which, you know, as is well known, economic power and economic influence easily extends itself to political influence at the expense of the political influence of everyone else, thereby undermining the basic democratic ideals that we think are so valuable.
And then I guess the other major problem that Wolf emphasizes, maybe more than others, is the economic instability of capitalist systems, the fact that they seem to be subject to regular boom and bust cycles, and the negative impacts of those busts in the cycles that are especially harmful to working and sort of lower class people.
Yeah, and as he notes, what's maybe morally relevant there is who causes those periods of bust or depression, right? It's not the people who suffer the consequences of those economic downturns, but the capitalist class who is in power, at least that's the claim, which adds a little bit of extra moral edge, a little bit of extra unfairness or injustice to it. Okay, so those are the symptoms, but there's lots of disagreement about what the cause of them is. And obviously for most economists who are sort of mainstream economists, they're not going to say capitalism is the underlying disease. Wolf is in the camp of someone like Marx, who says there's something inherent to capitalism which is going to lead to these things, and unless you do something about that, then you're going to continue to have these problems, these symptoms. What are some of the, obviously people disagree with that. I mean, so what are the other kinds of approaches that have been taken with respect to these symptoms?
It depends on whether you're talking about theorists who are working from within classical economic theory or outside of it. You know, there, as you mentioned, there's considerable disagreement even from within classical economic theory. And this is the thing that he takes up at length in the first part of the book, where he's contrasting sort of classical neoliberal economic approaches to downturns against the Keynesian approaches to economic downturns. And sort of he tracks the history of this from, you know, the beginning of the Great Depression through the FDR administration, and basically sort of goes through the ways in which the the neoliberal sort of classical approach is to favor austerity, right? Basically, when you're in a bust cycle and your society is not producing the level of profits that it was before, then what you ultimately have to do to get it back on track is to shrink the size of your government and the kind of services that your government provides to ensure that the capital that is available is invested in economic activity, which will create growth and help you out of that recession or depression or what have you. And as he knows, he favors the sort of Keynesian alternative to that if you have to work within those two approaches, right? The two sort of dominant capitalist approaches, where the Keynesians say, no, austerity is actually it is not the cure for these downturns. If anything, it is going to amplify the problems, right? Because the part of the problem is that there isn't, so this is where I have to explain economics that I'm not comfortable with. So the Keynesian thinks, well, essentially what's at the heart of the problem is that you don't have, as the economy is receding, you don't have the level of consumer demand is also receding. And as a result, you don't have the demand necessary to incentivize growth and to incentivize the investment in productive activity. And the way around that is for the government to get involved, right, and to essentially take out debt as a way of increasing consumer demand and also the available capital that can then be put into the economy to spur more productive activity so that the economy grows again so that you eventually get out of a recession, right? And that what that means in large part is investing in the human capital that otherwise would be wasted if the government wasn't involved and you had high unemployment and all the things that typically go with austerity approaches.
Yeah. So the Keynesian approach will also probably involve the raising of taxes on businesses and the wealthy as well. And so he cites FDR and the New Deal era as kind of a paradigmatic period of Keynesian kind of economic policy.
Right. And in his history, and this is sort of common to sort of progressive tellings of American economic history, it was during this sort of Keynesian period from the beginning of the FDR administration through up to the 1970s that we saw real wage growth in the U.S. And, you know, we saw what's many consider to be a kind of golden economic period in the U.S. But then there was a reversion back to more sort of classical neoliberal approaches from the 1970s up through the crash of 2008, and ultimately he cites those political changes as one of the primary causes for the Great Recession of 2008.
And as he points out, both the mainstream Democratic Party and Republican Party fall on this kind of classical neoliberal side. Rhetorically, the Democratic Party may sound more Keynesian at times, but in practice, they've also been, and he goes through some of the details, but you could see them as pursuing similar kinds of policies of shrinking government.
Clinton's welfare reform is
peeling back,
obvious example.
Right, social welfare programs, et cetera. Now, what's interesting is that, so he's sort of in favor economically of the Keynesian approach, but he sees a crucial flaw in it, which you can kind of see in the very quick, brief messy sketch of this history that we've given, which is that provided it's the capitalists, the wealthy capitalists, who are still making the decisions, so inevitably inequality is going to increase. And as inequality increases, inequality and political influence also increases. And they will be working tirelessly with greater resources to peel back those kinds of Keynesian programs so that they can increase their own wealth.
Right. And I mean, one of the important historical points that he makes is that the FDR administration didn't just sort of on its own adopt the Keynesian approach and favor it, right? There was considerable social pressure from the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, and other radical political socialist movements or socialist groups to pressure the FDR administration to make, to adopt the, what at the time seemed like really significant reforms. Of course, for 30 years, they became the status quo. But at the time, it seemed like an incredibly radical idea to expand the social safety net, to create a, you know, a massive jobs program, a social security administration, things like that. And it was under intense social pressure that FDR was able to achieve this. And he was able to actually and had to get those business interests to buy into this kind of reformation. But, I mean, it's worth noting they didn't just do it on their own, right? They weren't happy about it. They basically had to be threatened with even more radical alternatives.
So the way Wolf frames it is that the Keynesian approach is a compromise position between a more radical revision of capitalism and the status quo, which, as you said, many social groups were increasingly finding unacceptable.
And I mean, one of the sort of interesting analogies that he uses is he basically says, like, look, at in some sense, this was class warfare, right? Understood in the sort of economic terms that people were engaging in. But the primary reason that he is dissatisfied with the Keynesian approach is, and he uses this analogy explicitly somewhere. I can't remember if it's the book or his talk at Google, but he basically says, what happens when you have actual warfare and one side comes out victorious? Well, they force the disarmament of the other side. Why? Because if they don't, they know that eventually the other side is going to pick their weapons back up and strike again at some point. And that's what he thinks happens when you take the Keynesian approach. You don't ultimately disarm the capitalist class and remove from them the primary mechanisms they have to mess with your politics, to peel back those political reforms that you put in place to build a social safety net. Right? And so he thinks as long as they retain those arms, that wealth, that massive wealth, and the institutional mechanisms to be able to influence politics, eventually they're going to use it. And eventually you're going to end up seeing the peeling back of whatever gains the working class end up achieving.
And then you are led inevitably once again into crisis of one kind or another. Okay, so fundamentally, he sees the really deep problem with capitalism as being that in capitalism, capitalists ultimately have greater decision-making power, or perhaps all the decision-making power about economic activity, and inevitably, this will bleed over into the political realm, and so they can dictate policy and politics, and they can thus use that mechanism to shape to ensure that the economic conditions are even more favorable to them at the expense of everyone else. So at the heart of this is this fundamental lack of democracy in the economic sphere, right? Democracy requires that something like that everyone have some kind of equal political influence or equal influence over decision making. But obviously in the economic sphere, that's not the case. It's shareholders and the board of directors, and your typical worker has very little say over what happens at their job. Okay, so the solution is to somehow democratize the workplace. How does one do that? What is it? What is it to democratize the workplace?
So in some ways, this question is, what is democracy? And the way to answer that for him, I think, starts with, well, why is it, you already sort of gestured at this, but why is it the case that private capitalist workplaces are undemocratic, right? And his answer to that is, well, it has to do with the fact that the board of directors that make really all of the decisions about what a company is going to produce, what it's going to do with the surpluses that it produces, that board of directors is decided by the shareholders, right? And the way that works typically is it's for every share that a person owns, they get a vote in the board of directors, right? It's not one person, one vote. It's one share, one vote, right? And so it's a highly undemocratic system, obviously, because the shares aren't distributed equally among society. And so to get away from that and to make it democratic, And to make workplaces democratic would require that workers all have say in their workplace, right? And if it's really democratic and egalitarian, then workers have the sort of same level of say. So it's one person, one vote, as opposed to one share, one vote in deciding the overall activities that the company is going to engage in, right? And it, so essentially what has to happen, he thinks, is workers have to have say in what the companies that they work for produce, what is going to be done with the surpluses that are produced. Is that going to be invested in, is that going to be paid out to the workers as dividends? Is that going to be invested in the growth of the company, right? There are a lot of different things you can do with surpluses. And he thinks in order for the workplace to be democratic, it needs to be the case that the people who are doing, who are engaged in the production are the ones who have some, who have final say over the direction of their companies.
Okay, now, so a lot of people will hear, all right, criticisms of capitalism, and they'll hear socialize, and they'll hear, you know, Richard Wolff is a self-described Marxist and perhaps socialist, and they'll think, okay, so what's being advocated for here is, you know, a communist system in the way that we typically understand it, like Soviet Russia, perhaps with democracy, which is, you can have those things, right? You could have people vote on who composes the state and then have communism as we typically understand it. But that's not what he's talking about.
No, not at all.
So why would that not count as a, just so we can, you know, clarify here, why is that not an instance? How is this idea to democratize the workplace different? Why would those kinds of systems not count?
Right. So he actually calls, so when talking about systems like in the Soviet Union, he actually calls those forms of state capitalism. Now, why does he still think of that as capitalism? Well, for him, the sort of core element of a capitalist system is this, the way in which workplaces are structured that determine who gets to decide what's produced by a company and what's done with the surpluses of that company.
Where the surpluses just means like the profit that's generated.
Right, the profit, all of the excess production, like it doesn't, it's not typically. I mean, there's a nuance there, but we can skip over that.
Okay, so in the Soviet Russia case, in that kind of communist situation, what you have is a kind of national ownership, and then you can say, well, everyone's part of the state. And if it involved democracy, then you could see a kind of sense in which that's democratic, but it's not. It would be highly indirectly democratic. And what happens instead is that you get members of the state who are not workers. They are not, you know, people involved in the production of the actual goods. They are the ones who appropriate the surplus and decide what to do with it. And they also, because there's state planning involved, they decide what the economic activities are as well. So that ends up being a highly undemocratic situation.
Yeah, and it's interesting. In some ways, what he takes himself to be doing is returning to sort of the Marxist analysis of capitalist economies. And what he's observing is, and this is something that a lot of people who are familiar with Marx will, this is the phrase that a lot of people will associate with Marx, is the alienation of workers from the fruits of their labor, right? That is a core part of capitalist systems. And it's a major part of the Marxist critique of capitalist systems. And basically what he's observing is that alienation still existed in the Soviet Union. The people who grabbed the surpluses and decided what to do with it, those weren't the people producing them, right? So the workers were still being alienated from their work. And he says at one point in the book, it's the exclusion, and now I'm directly quoting, the exclusion from economic decision-making on the job is what seemed to lead many workers to refuse or exclude themselves from community decision-making elsewhere. So for him, this alienation of labor ultimately undermined the sort of democratic principles that such a system would require in order to sort of overcome the fact that workers don't get any say in what's done with work that they're producing or the product of their labor.
Okay, so interesting. So he thinks not only would workplace democracy kind of prevent capitalists from dominating politics because it would sort of sever their, it would prevent them from, and we haven't really explained why yet, but gaining massive amounts of resources and using that to undermine the political system. But also it will encourage everyone else or make them better able to get involved in the democratic process. So, I mean, if nothing else, and this, again, is just to reiterate what we ended up saying in the What is Capitalism episode, this discussion highlights another variable in economic systems that's often overlooked, right? People think of communism or socialism, they think state planning. It's markets versus state planning. That is an important variable for sure. But there's also questions about who owns the means of production. And sometimes that's taken to be private individuals versus the state. But there's also other options, like the workers could collectively own it. And then there's very closely related but perhaps separate questions about who does the decision making when it comes to economic activity. So there are lots of fine and interesting variables here which we can use to distinguish between different kinds of systems or different variants of systems. Okay, so we have really roughly some kind of idea of what it is for a workplace to be democratized. We'll get more fine-grained into detail later. And we have some sense of systems which are not sufficiently democratic. And we have on the table the idea that the lack of democracy in the economic sphere is ultimately the cause of some serious problems of capitalism. And then also on the table, naturally, is the idea that the way to solve these problems is to have more democracy in the workplace. So let's talk a little bit more about those arguments. Why is it that, perhaps in a little bit more detail, a lack of democracy leads to these problems, and why is it that more democracy would help solve them? Because that connection hasn't been made yet, and there's a lot sort of in the middle between that shift and the kinds of symptoms that we talked about of capitalism.
Okay, so why is more democracy a cure for the various problems that we described earlier as sort of the common symptoms of capitalism? Well, why does the undemocratic nature of capitalist systems tend to produce those problems? His answer is largely just, well, when we are making economic decisions, when people make economic decisions, the kind of social costs and the kind of benefits that they factor into those decisions ultimately depend on whose interests are being represented, right? And this really isn't a new idea when it comes to our political institutions, right? We're all familiar with the fact that our political institutions tend to act in the interests of those who have the capacity to influence the political process. Or the reason we think democracies are better than the alternatives, one of the primary arguments for that is that everybody's interest has the potential to be represented under a democratic government in ways that wouldn't happen under a monarchy or if an oligarchy, right? And he basically thinks that just as an oligarchy is going to promote the interests of the ruling class, right, the wealthy, so a capitalist system that's completely undemocratic in terms of how economic decisions are made is going to promote the interests of the ruling class. So it's not going to factor in the costs of various decisions to anybody except the people who happen to get votes in the economic decisions that are being made, right? So we could go through each of the issues that we highlighted one by one and see why it would make sense that and the undemocratic nature of the capitalist system would tend to lead to decisions that are harmful to the vast majority.
All right, so let's get some examples. So when you're talking about the ruling class here, you're talking about shareholders. They're the people who ultimately, they own some portion of the business and they get to make decisions. You could also be talking about the board of directors. Of course, the shareholders will help determine who that is, but they have the sort of more immediate control over what happens. But their aim, typically, now this doesn't have to be the case, right? You could have a benevolent board of directors or benevolent shareholders who have whatever aims they please, but typically the aim is to maximize their profits. For shareholders, they might want greater dividends, you know, they might want the stock price to go up, whatever it is, so that they can make more money. And so then, right, just to fill this out, the concern is that the workers, the laborers, are nothing. They're nothing more than tools to tools for increasing that profit for them, right? So, and not just to take a really obvious kind of example, it could be that the company can make a bit more money by laying off half of its employees for whatever reason. The cost to the employees who will become unemployed is totally irrelevant to their calculation in what to do there, right? They're just going to be like, oh, okay, yes, obvious business sense. But of course, this ends up being harmful to many people. And it's a great cost to those people for a probably very marginal gain for the shareholders. Just to sort of give a common sense, obvious example of how this plays out.
Yeah. So, I mean, you can extend this to all variety of other kinds of common social ills that a capitalist society produces, right? So it's not just the poverty and inequality that it produces, which I think your last example explains reasonably well, but it's also things like the environment, right? What Wolf observes is that when the shareholders or the board of directors are making economic decisions, those decisions are going to have environmental impacts. However, it's often the case that the people who are producing whatever it is that the company produces are the ones who live in the communities that are ultimately going to have to accept and deal with those environmental impacts. So the people who are going to end up having to live with the decisions that the board of directors make are not the people who get to make those decisions, right? And the board of directors, if they don't live in the same communities as the people who are doing the work, don't have to be concerned with the environmental impact that their decisions are going to have, right? And so you can end up with a deprioritization of environmental concerns when you have the kind of organizations that we do, where the stakeholders and the decision makers are ultimately not the ones who have to deal at least with the direct impact of the decisions that they're making.
Right. So it's for the same reason that they're insulated from the risks and costs of maybe a dangerous workplace, right? It's the same reasons why they might not care about worker safety. They're also not going to care about the safety of the local community or the health of the local community, perhaps except insofar as it undermines their workers' ability to do their job. And you know, one thing that is kind of relevant here, we don't need to talk about this now, but it's sort of in the background, is there are going to be those capitalists like John Mackey who say, no, right, what capitalism is or that these symptoms of capitalism are pointing us to is that really smart businesses actually care about the community and their employees, I guess because they have a really optimistic view about... I mean, there is a way in which if people started caring really a lot about these things and they boycotted businesses who, you know, polluted in local communities or did whatever else, they would suffer.
Well, I do think that gets at an interesting point of pushback that Wolf doesn't consider much, if at all, in the book, which is that, so he basically, in his framing of who gets to make decisions, focuses exclusively on the board of directors and the shareholders and the way in which they get to make these decisions about what to produce and what to do with the surpluses of what's produced. But the obvious place to push back is in the way that most defenders of capitalism will, is they'll say, well, hold on a second. The shareholders and the board of directors have to be responsive to consumer demand, right? At the end of the day, yes, they get to make decisions about what to produce, but whether they're rewarded for those decisions depends on whether the things that they produce are actually beneficial to the mass of people who could potentially buy their products, right? And so there is a way in which consumers have some say in the choices that the board of directors make. Now, the obvious reply is, well, wait a minute. Is it the case that the consumers are really, when they're making purchases, voting on whether they approve of these environmental conditions or not, right? It's only if those concerns are factored into consumer decisions that they really are making rational choices about those things.
Yeah, I mean, that's a whole other topic, which we could talk about at length, some of the basic assumptions that are in place in typical economic analyses concerning the rationality of consumers and everything else. I do want to just say, you know, one thing you pointed to that was interesting in considering the parallels to oligarchy here. One interesting question is, right, how does oligarchy justify its own rule, right? Because usually, or you know, even a monarchy, right? And traditionally, it'd be something like divine right, or perhaps for the oligarchy, they just think they're sort of better, maybe not divine right, but they're superior in some way. And the capitalist class has something like that. Not to say that they think they're, you know, blessed.
No,
by
I
the
think
gods.
It's actually no. I think the analogy is really tight. Right?
Well, it depends. I mean, there's a couple. So that might be the true justification for a lot of those folks, right? They do think they're just better than everyone else. But no, actually, what makes it perhaps a bit tougher is that classical economics. There's a classical economic story which backs them up, right? They're going to say, look. As it turns out, because of invisible hand of the market reasons, if we're going to do the most good, what we should do is maximize our profit. And this is the Milton Friedman kind of line. Because when we do that, then we can raise wages for workers, we can create lower prices for consumers, and that's wonderful. Right? So there is that. I mean, one of the things that one has to argue against is that big sort of mainstream neoliberal argument that this is how we produce the greatest good.
Yeah, and I think we will come back to these arguments next week. I think
for sure.
You know, there are these widespread defenses of capitalism that we'll have to consider. And the obvious pushback against worker self-directed enterprises and this kind of democratization of work would be that they are maybe. I think it's fairly obvious that they would be beneficial to people as workers. And one of the major pushbacks is going to be, but is it going to be beneficial to them as consumers? Now, maybe, right? But that at least is one of the points of contention where you can easily foresee objections from capitalists who say, look, it's true, we don't necessarily optimize people's well-being as workers, but there are incredible benefits as consumers that you get from the systems that we produce. And of course, that's one of the central questions that the, you know, self-directed enterprises raises. Could these enterprises actually be as economically productive? If they could, I mean, it's arguable, or it's an empirical question, really.
People actually go both ways on this.
Yeah.
Okay, so one of the reasons why a lack of democracy in the workplace is bad is that currently the incentives of those who are making the economic decisions run against the general well-being of most people, of the majority of people, whether it's people living in a particular community or workers, and this is bad. So if we increase democracy in the workplace, then because the workers and decision makers and people living in the community will be the same people, then the idea is that their incentives will be to promote their own well-being, and so perhaps the majority of people will be better off. You won't have this basic conflict of incentives. So then one of the things we have to talk about then is, well, what about the connections to political power and democracy that Wolf sees as so important? Why would democracy in the workplace increase or help to foster real democracy in the political sense?
There are two different dimensions to an answer to that question, right? So on the one hand, I think you have to focus at a kind of macro level, right, which we've kind of talked about already. So if you have a capitalist system that allows for the accumulation of massive amounts of wealth, then the people who have accumulated that wealth are in a position to advocate for their political and economic interests in a way that nobody else can, right? So the system ends up being skewed in the favor of the wealthy, much the way that we've talked about in our very first couple of episodes, right? And so that's part of the reason why he thinks that a worker self-directed enterprise system would avoid some of those problems, right? It just comes down to the fact that he thinks that less inequality will result from, you know, worker self-directed.
Yeah, can we examine that a little bit? I mean, because it's not obvious, right? Why think that, whether he's right or wrong, right? Why think that increasing workplace democracy would lead to a decrease in economic inequality?
So there's some I mean, there are some case studies already, right, that would suggest that a certain kind of inequality that develops in private capitalist enterprises will be eliminated, right? In particular, the ratio or the differential between CEOs and boards of directors and their pay relative to everybody else, right, will be far less likely in a worker.
Right, because in a worker democracy, then the workers will have to vote on things like what the pay scale is or what the salaries are for particular positions, and they're probably not going to say that the CEO should get however many hundreds of times more in right. wages than they do. Okay, so that's one source of income inequality that should be mitigated, probably substantially, in a workplace democracy. Okay,
and maybe you might think like you then are not going to see the kind of massive inequality that we see today, where you have a 1% versus a 99% kind of, where 1% owns 50% of, you know, the world basically. So that could, I think it's reasonable to think that it would eliminate a significant kind of inequality that seems especially problematic. On the other hand, I'm sympathetic to your concern. So, and I was highly inspired, or this thought's inspired by the work of Richard Reeves in his book Dream Hoarders, where he argues that the left has been too focused on the distinction between the 1% and the 99%, and really thinks that there's a class struggle going on between the 20% and the 80%, right? And when you focus on the differences between sort of the top 20% of income earners, people, the top 20% typically are people who have been educated at, you know, our private, fancy, prestigious institutions, and they may not occupy the same sort of super privileged position of the 1%, but they still end up accumulating a significant portion of our society's wealth. And when you think of like the entities that exist that are highly productive, they are often occupied by people from that specific social group, right? And insofar as worker democracies are set up so that the people doing the production are the ones who get to acquire or appropriate all of the surplus, if that 20%, in virtue of their educations and other things, end up working for companies that are more productive,
right,
you can still see a divergence in terms of the overall accumulation of wealth.
Yeah, so obviously there's major differences in profitability from company to company within a field, but then also there's major differences in profitability between fields as well, right? And you know, obviously if you're working at a gas station or something, and there's a worker democracy there, you're probably going to make probably just not very much money. I don't know how much a gas station makes, but you know, you can imagine when it doesn't make that much, there isn't going to be that much to go around. So you can have still major differences in income. But the other thing you pointed to before is, I mean, the starker inequality, the starker economic inequality is wealth inequality, which obviously income inequality is related to that. But how does that get fixed? I mean, that might even be more important.
We have to seize the wealth of the rich, obviously.
I mean, I guess this gets beyond what we want to talk about now, but I mean, one question is like, would implementing Wolf's approach, I mean, is that going to just require dispossessing lots of people? Presumably, right? All shareholders are just going to be dispossessed on a huge scale, right?
Yeah, I don't know. Probably.
Yeah.
I mean, there are, of course, places that have been experimenting with worker democracy that haven't required dispossession,
right,
of the capitalist class. And I guess for now, we'll stay neutral on the question of revolution.
I guess the other way you could see this addressing inequality is much more indirect and roundabout. And I'm reminded of criticisms Matt Brunig has made, and he's someone who's worked a lot on universal basic income. And he's made some criticisms of approaches like Wolf's, which seek, you know, transformation of an economic system by having greater democracy in the workplace. And his point is just that this actually won't do that much to help inequality. It won't do as much as having robust safety nets or a basic income. But you can imagine And I think Wolf has this in mind, a highly indirect way in which democracy might reduce inequality is that if it's true that having democracy in the workplace creates greater democracy politically, then we can expect or at least hope that we'll have policies which are more friendly to the majority, things like a basic income, which perhaps would be quite robust, or just stronger safety nets in general, which would do a lot to at least mitigate some of the major harms of inequality.
Right. And it's one thing that we haven't mentioned, but is part of his proposal, is that he doesn't just imagine that the worker democracies function sort of independently of the political system to just make whatever decisions they want, that they ultimately have to work in conjunction with the communities that they're embedded and come to agreements with those communities about how their economic activity will proceed and so on. So, it's not as though he's advocating a kind of worker democracy libertarianism or anything, and ultimately sees, multiple dimensions to the solution. Part of it is just having the democratization of workplace, right, for the reasons that we've given. But he also sees a significant role to be played on the political side as well. And I think he, for the most part, thinks that the psychology of people is a significant barrier to achieving the kind of political goals that you just mentioned. And having worker democracy is a critical part of shaping people's psychology to be more engaged democratically, right? And to have the kind of democratic and egalitarian spirit that would lead to the adoption of public policies that are beneficial to everybody.
Okay, well, I think that's sort of just a good start. We've just tried to lay out some of the basic themes and arguments of the book without subjecting them to too much criticism, without getting too much into the details of worker democracy, which we can do a bit more next week. And then also we'll consider some of the pressing criticisms and questions that should be raised about these kinds of proposals.
Yeah, I think there are – we've already started, I think, to highlight some of the kinds of concerns that will – needs to come back to, right? Like that it's really going to solve inequality, as we discussed, there are issues there. A thing we absolutely will need to come back to is the question of automation, right? So like a key theme in the book, and a key question that whenever he presents this material, he has us come back to is to imagine how a worker democracy would approach a question of, should we adopt this new technology that will make us more productive? Well, what if that technology is going to require layoffs? Well, then is it going to be worth the investment, right? And on the one hand, you can see how that asking that kind of question can create a more humane workplace, right? On the other hand, you can see obvious concerns from the defenders of capitalism.
So there's all kinds of questions to be raised about what the effects of adopting this kind of system would be, especially on a large scale. Questions about productivity, right? Right. We're not going to deny that productivity is valuable. It is. It certainly has a potential to be, as we've emphasized previously. And all of these other questions about inequality and the environment and so on. Then we also have to consider whether there are the non-consequentialist moral goods. How valuable, how important is it for workers to have autonomy over their work, right? That could be a good in and of itself, and you have to sort of consider that as well. But again, we'll get into this stuff in more detail next week. This week was just sort of laying out the broad picture, and then we can jump in with some fun stuff next week. So anyways, we thank you for listening to this, and if you're interested in what we've been talking about, again, the book is Richard Wolff's Democracy at Work, The Cure for Capitalism. And next week we'll dive into some potential criticisms to be made of the proposal and raise some important questions.
So thanks for making the mistake of listening to this episode. And we hope that you make the mistake next week.
This is why you're not the host, Michael. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.